From the campus of the University of Hawaii, this is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Lecture Series Podcast. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at hawaii.edu/CSEAS and at iTunes.
The Center for Japanese Studies, thank you very much, and the Center for Southeast Asian Studies. Before I begin, I just want to enjoy an anecdote, but when I was 40 years ago, before some of you were born, 40 years ago, I was sitting in a lecture class in Ithaca, New York, and the doyen of Southeast Asian Studies, D.G. Hall, came rushing in rather late and said, "I've just read a wonderful thesis. It's the best thesis I've ever read." And it was only some years later that I found out that that thesis was Surapati, Man and Legend, written by Anne Kumar. I should have known about her already. Of course, she was all in Australia. She was already, in the ANU context, she was a person of some renown. She graduated with honours, her BA, and she received a university medal, which means something in that context. And her honours have continued in 2003. The Australian government awarded her the centenary medal for her contribution to the study of Asia in Australia. And she is currently, of course, a professor in the Faculty of Asian Studies at the Australian National University, but she's also concurrently director of the International Centre of Excellence for Asian and Pacific Studies.
Not anymore.
Just resigned. And she's held several other important positions, including vice president for the Australian Academy of the Humanities. Her research record is equally impressive. She's published, of course, in addition to Surapati, Illuminations, which some of you know, a beautiful book jointly published in Indonesia, and Java and Modern Europe, which the history students will know. But over the last, I suppose, 15 years, she's turned her attention to looking at the early history of Japan and its connections with the southern areas of Asia. And the results of that research will be published as we speak, or in press as we speak, Globalizing the Prehistory of Japan, Language, Genes, and Civilization. And that will be published by Routledge in 2008. And some of the ideas in that book will be presented today in the talk that Anne is entitled Java and Japan, A New View of the Yayoi Revolution. So please join with me in welcoming Dr. Kumar to our panel.
Barbara, for an extremely kind introduction, which I find it very difficult to live up to. I'm afraid that after our excellent PowerPoint presentation by Dane on Tuesday, we're about to take a giant leap backwards in technological terms to see that the trusty overhead slide projector is there because I don't have my computer with me. It's also the case that this seminar skims rather lightly over work that took 20 years to accumulate the data and analyze it. And even allowing for the fact that I'm probably four times as slow and cautious as most scholars, this is still a lot of material. So if I'm going too fast or if you need further clarification, please ask me at any time. Now, you don't often see the words with which the title begins, Java and Japan, together. This is because they belong to two different boxes, Northeast Asia, or sometimes just East Asia, and Southeast Asia. And I thought I was going to have a chalkboard, which would have been a real leap back into my academic origin. But I'll make just a whiteboard. Graphically, which is hopefully written. clearer than making it words. So it's either going to be too many countries, or just put the first Burma, Thailand, Vietnam. Japan is in the East Asia category, South, and this is the Southeast Asia category. For Java, you have to further unpack Indonesia, which contains Java. So they dwell in rather different conceptual worlds, and the history of Java has been quite significantly subsumed into the history of Indonesia and Southeast Asia, which is not the case with Japan. If you do find these two words together, they're probably in connection with the Japanese occupation. But today I want to look at a much older period of history and suggest that the relations between the two countries are much older than we have hitherto realized. I'm not at all sure that these two categories are the very best way of dealing with the history of this area of Asia. For example, if you look at the way Western European history is dealt with, you don't find that there's a division between North Western Europe and South Western Europe with a different trade union of specialists dealing with each area. And if it were to be so divided, you would find it very difficult to deal with topics like, for instance, Roman Britain, which would span the two categories. So today I'm trying to break down the rigid, the rather rigid way in which we looked at things. Now, the topic of the talk is the Yayoi period, which is a period that's long been regarded as having great importance and which one can reasonably describe as both momentous and mysterious. It happened over, the time period is over 2,000 years ago. And there happened in Japan one of the most dramatic transformations in the history of human society. This is the massive discontinuity between the so-called Jomon and Yayoi cultures. In the second half of the first millennium before Christ. At this time, the hunter-gatherer way of life of Jomon Japan was totally transformed by a whole range of innovations. And these innovations were not just equal to, but greater than those brought about by other great transformations. Thus, they included the massive changes that took place elsewhere in the world in the Neolithic, or New Stone Age revolution, which saw the introduction of agriculture and other major changes in society and culture, such as the development of better tools, occupational specialization, accumulation of property, development of larger social groups and status distinctions, and the development of symbolic aspects of human culture, such as the concepts of the afterlife, which we see reflected in sacred objects. In the Yayoi period, Japan underwent these major changes. Agriculture in this case took the form of wet rice farming and larger settled communities with specialization and social hierarchy. They included the new technology and new socio-political and religious structures which in Europe and elsewhere were introduced at a later stage too. So as well as the Neolithic changes, they included the changes which in Europe came in the Bronze and Iron Ages, including obviously bronze and iron working, and also a new architecture, a new religion, and the beginnings of a hierarchical society which would produce the imperial line of Japan. In other words, the Yayoi period saw the compression into a relatively short period of changes which in other places had taken place over a very much longer period. So after the long 10,000 year, persistence of the hunter-gatherer mode of existence during the Jomon period, the Yayoi transformation, which represents both the beginning of agriculture and the beginning of a rather sophisticated civilization in a single process, took place within just a few centuries. Timeline, which may be helpful. Of course, everybody wants to know who and what brought about these changes. For some time, there were two schools of thought about the process. One school of thought believed that the Jomon themselves had made all these new innovations, and the other school thought that the innovations were due to migrants. With the passage of time over the last 20 or so years, the majority of scholars believe that migrants were responsible because the archaeological evidence, that is the skeletal finds, indicate that a different type of person came on the scene at this time. The question then became, where did these migrants come from? Virtually everybody assumed that they must have come from the Asian mainland. In recent times, the dominant position on Japan's population history has been Kei Hanihara's dual structure hypothesis. Now, this can be outlined as follows. In the Pleistocene period, which ended about 10,000 years ago, the archipelago was settled by what he called proto-mongoloid people from Southeast Asia. These were the ancestors of the Jomon period, and their physical characteristics can still be seen in the Ainu and Okinawan populations. From the Yayoi period, populations with a quite different Northeast Asian or Neo-Mongoloid morphology began to arrive in Japan in quite large numbers. These migrants had considerable genetic influence, particularly in Western Japan. In the Kofun period, which followed the Yayoi period, there was a rapid increase in the number of migrants, with the result that by the end of the 7th century, about 90% of the Japanese population belonged to the migrant type. So, in other words, in early times, there's a Southeast Asian population in Japan, the Jomon, and then in the Yayoi period, there's the arrival of Northeast Asian migrants. There were some signs suggested to me that the Yayoi might be from somewhere else. This came from a "that's funny" moment. These words, according to Isaac Asimov, have been among the most productive of new discoveries, and more so than Eureka, because it's usually when people find something that's really funny and not explained by, it's very strange, can't be explained in the, according to the dominant paradigm, that they look for a new explanation. These signs suggested that there may have been contact at a time when a high civilization was already developing, and this seemed to fit with the Yayoi period. This ran contrary to K. Hanihara's dual structure hypothesis. I keep saying his initial because there are other Haniharas working on prehistory. However, I was certainly not the first to surmise that there was a significant southern element in Japanese history. This came up in specialist studies by people who weren't area specialists, for instance, people who were writing about masks, who were very struck by the striking similarities between Japanese and Javanese masks. Even more significant, because it proved a genetic rather than a typological relationship, was the work of a Japanese scientist called Morinaga, who was working in the 1960s on the relationship between Japanese rice and Javanese bulu rice. This is a rice which was developed in Java, which has become very widespread. For instance, it's grown in the Philippines, in Taiwan, and it's been taken as far as Madagascar. Morinaga found that this Javanese rice was the closest genetic relative of ordinary Japanese rice. And T.T. Chang, who was for a long time the chief research scientist at IRI, also was of the opinion that bulu rice had been introduced into Japan. T.T. Chang was one of a number of people whom I shall mention as I go, who gave me a great deal of help in this research. I think it was probably among linguists that work on a southern element had been most highly developed. Here I will deal first with the bioanthropological and DNA evidence, and then the linguistic evidence. Although this suggests that I was rather more methodical than I actually was, because I was sort of doing both at once in a rather muddly fashion. However, I don't see any reason why you should have to go through the muddly bits. And so I re-examined the evidence for the Hanehara hypothesis. Initially, I looked at the traditional indicators of human relationships, which have been used for a long time. These are particularly the study of teeth and skulls. Writing is a bit small, but the basic point is that this is the Southeast Asian group, this is the Northeast Asian group, and the Yayoi fall within the Southeast Asian group. This is a study of skulls. See that we probably can't see actually, but the Chinese are here, and the Japanese are here. The Ainus are well separated up there, and the Yayoi and Indonesians are lying very close to each other here. I found some of these sorts of things. This is a study by a Russian scientist called Kozintsev, and this is how the his data fell out, he treated these data selectively, which he said was a long-standing tradition of Soviet anthropology, and he removed those data which showed the Yayoi close to the Indonesians, because this didn't seem to be a reasonable classification. This work was a bit, sometimes a bit disillusioning about the way scientists operate, but that's another story. Well, I actually did a survey of the studies of teeth and skulls and sent it to a Japanese journal. And this was one of the strangest experiences in this research. They sent it to reviewers, and the reviewers said, well, yes, you know, she's done a comprehensive and accurate study of the teeth and skulls. Why isn't there anything on D-loops? And the editor wrote back and said, you have to do D-loops. And I thought, well, I hadn't the faintest idea what the D-loop was. Australians have a strong sense of losing face, and I didn't really admit it. So I just thought, oh, well, they're not going to publish it, and I can't. I don't know anything about D-loops. And then 3 weeks later, the editor wrote to me and said, where is your D-loop study? Don't you realize that the deadline for the next paper, next edition of the journal is only 6 weeks away? So at that stage, I sort of had to ask about, among my friends, you know, I found out that D-loops was part of the DNA, and asked my friends, anybody around here know about DNA? And the friend said, try Simon Eastiel at the John Curtin School of Medical Research. He's pretty good. So fortunately, I didn't know that Simon Eastiel was not only pretty good, but a top world authority, an extremely busy person with a reputation for reducing postgraduate students to jellies. So I fronted up to his office and said, you know, what I need is a collection of D-loops from different Asian populations and sort of analyze it. And I have a very small amount of money left over from another project I could pay a graduate student. This, I was greeted with what I now realize was a stunned silence. I'm sure it was the first time in his distinguished career that a person with no scientific background had wandered into his office and said, you know, how about D-loop study? Anyway, to his very great credit, actually, said, yes, all right, you know, I've got a postgraduate student who could do this, and, you know, he may have been influenced by the fact that he was actually a co-author of the editor of the journal where the paper was submitted. And the co-author of the editor of the journal had himself devised a computer program for the analysis of such data. So we went ahead, I should say that the D-loop is part of mitochondrial DNA, in which the mutations are, on average, at least 20 times more frequent than in the nuclear DNA. And this is, they're even more frequent in a short segment, which is called the displacement loop, or the D-loop. And that makes them particularly suitable for establishing genetic relationships. So we worked away, and Simon, with extreme kindness, looked at the results and helped enormously with the analysis. So we managed to get to the journal within the 6 weeks, incredibly. And it showed that Indonesians and Japanese share certain sites to the exclusion of other Asian populations. And it was published in 1998. Subsequently, 6 years later, from that point onward, there were more and more studies that appeared which threw doubt on the Honeyhauer hypothesis. And then finally, although most people continue to adhere to it for a good long time, and DNA increasingly replaced teeth and skulls as a means of establishing genetic relationships. And in 2004, a large research group headed by the Japanese professor Tanaka sequenced the entire Japanese mitochondrial genome. About this study was it showed just how complex Japanese population history really is and how ancient these various elements are. It's a real eye-opener on the issue of how much global movement there has been in the world for how long. And as Tanaka pointed out, previous studies of Japanese population history hadn't taken into account this complexity. The main findings were that Japan shares a large number of habitats with Korea, but there are other significant elements in the population. There is a significant number of shared habitats with southern China, some with northern China, and there is a significant sharing of habitats with Tibet. So at some very ancient period, there is a Tibetan element in the Japanese population. And in addition, there exists a minor percentage of exclusive sharing with Indonesia. This is the only element in which the Indonesian element is only with mainland Japanese and not with any other of the Asian populations studied. So it's confirmed the finding of my earlier study. And the authors concluded that the ancient Japanese came from northern Asia and that southern areas affected Japan by later migration. So in other words, this is the reverse of the Hanihara hypothesis. Instead of the southern elements being early and the northern elements being later, it's the other way around. The northern elements are earlier and the southern elements are later. Point where there's been a switching of the ideas about who got there first. Now, of course, if there has been a late southern migration, then it's would be nice to be able to narrow it down. And also, if there are migrants who came in the Yayoi period and made significant changes, we'd like to know what language they spoke. As almost every educated person knows, the history of the Japanese language is very highly contested, and it has been linked with all sorts of languages. The front runners are the two language families, Altaic and Austronesian. Altaic is part of the hypothesized superfamily Ural-Altaic, of which Uralic and Altaic are the main sub-branches. And Austronesian is a very widespread family of languages, generally thought to have originated in or to have dispersed from Taiwan, although other suggestions have certainly been made. The Austronesians were great seafarers, and Austronesian groups spread southward to Indonesia and all the way across the Pacific, and their speakers also reached Madagascar, thus covering more than half of the globe. Now, the question has been about what sort of contribution these languages may have made to Japanese. Often Austronesian is regarded as a substratum and Altaic as a superstratum, but the other way around has also been suggested. Now, what do these terms mean? I know some of you are linguists and know perfectly well what they mean, but not everybody, I think, is a linguist. So let me just give a brief definition. A substratum comes into being when a group of speakers of one language shift to using another language, which is then affected by certain features of their original language. And examples are the influence of Gaelic speakers on the English spoken in Ireland, or the Yiddish substratum in New York English. So substratum influence is the effect of a politically or culturally non-dominant language on a dominant language, and does not usually have a very large impact on the lexicon or vocabulary of the borrowing language. Usually borrowed words are restricted to place names and unfamiliar items or concepts. Now, superstratum influence, in contrast, is the effect of a politically or culturally dominant language on another language or languages in the area. The Norman French English on the English influence on the English language after the Norman Conquest is a good example of superstratum influence. It had a major impact, of course, on English lexicon, which is typical of substratum influence, since it arises through the impact of a language that is a source of new concepts and ideas, which may be in the realm of culture or of science and technology or both. Now, many scholars, primarily Japanese, but also some European scholars, have deduced that there is some element in Japanese. I received a good deal of help and assistance from the very eminent Murayama Shichiro, who was, until his death relatively recently, Japan's most famous historical linguist. I would also like to acknowledge the help I have received from Alexander Bovin of this university, indeed of this building. One of the world's great specialists on the Altaic language, and we have collaborated for a long time, even though when we first met, our ideas on the Japanese language were extremely divergent. And I'm very grateful to Sasha for this help. Now, Murayama has written a very great deal on this question. He was initially of the opinion that Japanese had an Austronesian substratum and an Altaic superstratum. He changed his mind and argued subsequently that the theories which posited a Malayo-Polynesian substratum in Japanese ran up against the problem that one would expect the substratum to be covert, and this was not the case. He said that a very large portion of the basic vocabulary of the Japanese language is Malayo-Polynesian, as are certain morphological and phonological phenomena that are of great importance to the language. By contrast, he says, the identifiably Altaic elements are restricted to a few special features of the syntax, a portion of the morphology, and an extremely limited section of the vocabulary. Now, if the Austronesian was not a substratum, but a superstratum, it could have been deduced, although it actually wasn't, that it could only have come from one place, because there is, in fact, only one Austronesian society that in early times developed a great tradition based on a superbly well-developed rice agriculture, an extremely advanced metalworking technology, and a formidably hierarchical society buttressed by a powerful indigenous mythology. This was, of course, Java. Now, I didn't make this deduction, but I did notice that there were some rather large number of Javanese words in Japanese. In 2000, and in 2000, I published an article on this in another University of Hawaii icon, this time not a person, but a journal, Oceanic Linguistics, with my colleague Phil Rose, the last hero to appear on stage today. Again, a somewhat severe person with very high standards who was rather terrifying to work with, but in the end we produced the article, and since we were well aware, as we must have been, of the profound skepticism with which any new proposal about the affiliations of the Japanese language was bound to be greeted, we decided to set the bar extraordinarily high. We used only words with five segments, and I'm not aware that anybody else has done that, and also insisted on extremely close semantic agreement. I'd already published in 1996 a list of about 80 cognate pairs, but not all of them were five segments long. Of course, the reason that we did this limitation to five segment words was to eliminate any suggestion that this could have been chance. Now, you can find words in two unrelated languages which are not borrowings, but which have the same form and the same meaning, and linguists are fond of quoting these. And if you look at books on historical linguistics, you'll find that a few words are regularly cited. For instance, the English word bad, meaning bad, occurs in another language, also meaning bad. Is it Persian?
Persian.
Historical linguist Trask, to show how easy it was to find the same word by chance, drew up this list of words which were the same in Hawaiian and ancient Greek. Two languages which are maximally unlikely to have interacted. And he made this list, and there are some liberties have been taken with long and short vowels, but in fact, there are never actually more than three corresponding segments in that list, except for one word which has four corresponding segments. Can anybody see which one that is? A couple of you read it. It's meli, which is honey, and it is in fact a borrowing. It was borrowed into Hawaiian from the European language. So, in fact, you cannot really get more than three segments, and what's more important, you can't get regular recurrent correspondences. This is what I'm most proud of in the 2000 paper, that we produced a schedule of correspondences between the Japanese and the Javanese words. And anybody, any of the linguists wants to see it, I have some copies of it if you're interested. So, as with the DNA and other evidence, we've now switched around. Instead of there being a southern influence earlier and a northern influence later, it's northern first and the southern influence comes later. And we'd be able to specify where the southern influence comes from. That is, it comes from Javanese. It's also of interest that the semantic fields of the borrowings correspond to Yayoi innovations, like rice, buildings, fields and fences, metalworking, socio-economic relationships, hierarchy and divinity, but also certain amount of basic vocabulary, words like to cover, to pour, and to grow. In other words, there are quite a lot of verbs in the borrowings, which is relatively unusual. So, after 20 years of hard slog, I finally came to a conclusion which had been reached much more quickly by a Japanese visitor to Indonesia. Now, Barbara, you will recognize this. It's from one of your writings. Yes. And I in 1977. Yes. A visitor, a Japanese visitor, remarked, "For there is little doubt that we have Malay blood in our veins. When I visited these islands, I felt as if I were travelling in Kyushu, because the houses, the children, the fences around the houses, and everything in the lifestyle made me think of Japan." Now, this guy has just picked up on the Yayoi innovations, the houses and fences for which the words were borrowed, and the Kyushu location, which is one of the major Yayoi concentrations, which is kind of a remarkable demonstration of the ability of the human mind to compute all these diverse factors and come to a conclusion. Now, I think we have found something more out about the Yayoi period. Of course, there's very much still that could still be found. There are many mysteries that remain. For instance, the artifacts from this period bear certain symbols which are shared between Java and Japan. These are the tumpal or sawtooth pattern. Can you see this? I'll pass it around. This is a jotaku, and it has the tumpal or sawtooth pattern along the edges. It has a spiral pattern on the handle, and it has a comma as well on the other part of the handle, and it has a wave pattern. Now, these four motifs are also found on Javanese artifacts. This is an island Southeast Asian belt. And I don't know what they mean. The tumpal seems to be connected with the rice deity. The comma motif is found on sacred objects in Japan, but also is found on the statues of Javanese gods and kings and queens. So it's some association with divinity and royalty. But what exactly these motifs really symbolize is still a mystery. Some mystery about the Yayoi. Well, I think I've covered enough technical material for one seminar, and I'm happy to take questions.
You have, as you're well aware, put yourself out on the end of a very brittle limb. I admire your courage in being willing to sit in that position. Let me start by saying there are a number of questions that specialists, both I suppose Japanologists as well as Austronesianists, are troubled by in looking at this hypothesis. Let's just start with inherent plausibility. Okay, you have Javanese, pre-Indianized Javanese, in at least 300 BC, moving northwards with the whole of Indonesia, the whole of the Philippines, across Taiwan, across the Ryukyus, to enter Kyushu from the west, bringing rice, metallurgy, and horses, of all things, with them. That in itself raises lots of questions that need to be answered.
So can I start with that?
Start with that.
Okay, there's the inherent plausibility of Japanese getting from Java to Japan. Well, a friend of mine said to me, what, you mean they sailed up the map? And this is one's instinctive feeling, that somehow it's more improbable that Javanese got from Java to Japan than Koreans got from Korea to Japan. But let us remember, these are Austronesians. They are seafarers. And let us also remember that, in fact, it is harder to sail down the map than up the map, because the Kuroshio actually flows from Indonesia to Japan. Now, we know that they got Bulu rice up to Taiwan, so it's not really remarkable that they got it further onto Japan. So that's my feeling about that inherent thing. So please say.
Okay, well, I mean, sailing up a map, that doesn't bother me. What bothers me is that you've got so many places in between where these people, for whatever reason they were migrating, could have stopped. Why all the way to Kyushu, and then finally they found the place where they're interested in staying?
Well, why did they go all the way across the Pacific? Why did they go to Madagascar?
You're talking about Javanese now. We're not talking about the Austronesian expansion. It's a rather different thing. You're talking about one specific group in southern Indonesia.
Sure. Well, why is it different for one group than for another?
Well, the Austronesian expansion was a gradual expansion from island to island all the way out here to Hawaii. Okay? It wasn't as though a lot of islands were skipped and people came directly to Hawaii. Okay? But what you're talking about is a proposed migration in which people went from Java all the way across Indonesia, the Philippines, Taiwan, and the Ryukyus, landed in Kyushu. Why? The notion of motivation is a problematic one to start with. But that's okay. We can let that one go. There are other problems. The second thing that's difficult to deal with is sort of conceptual issue whether the Yayoi were Indonesians themselves or whether they were some other people who were influenced by Indonesian immigrants into southern Japan. And you seem to be kind of going both directions on this. I keep getting signals that they were the Yayoi, they were not the Yayoi, but they were influencing the Yayoi.
They migrated in the Yayoi period.
So they were the Yayoi?
Well, they were at least some of the Yayoi. The numbers indicated by Tanaka's DNA study shows there are about two or three times as many Indonesians in the Japanese gene pool as there were Norman French in England. So that's what we're looking at.
If they were the Yayoi, then we're not talking about borrowing from an Indonesian language into Japan. We're talking about an Indonesian language being introduced into Japan. Now that should be rather obvious to historical linguists today, because 2,000 years isn't that long to totally obscure the relationship. And it's not obvious to historical linguists that there is an Indonesian language spoken in Japan. If you want to look at specific etymologies from the 2000 article that you did with Phil Rose, we can do that over lunch or something if you'd like. But I mean, the first two really fall apart. Just take the first two and you look at them closely. If you go to Zoomover, let me just read this out loud so people can see where I'm coming from. The first one that you give is Old Japanese sawak, the call out. That's the way you gloss it in the article. Old Japanese from one of the two dictionaries you've used, sawak hyphen, to gather and make a noise in disorder, to gather and cry in tumult. The second source says to make a noise or to rustle, to be in a disordered or jumbled state. Now, this is in comparison with to call out in Old Japanese. Now, what Zuckmulder actually gives is sawak as an abstract root rather than an attested form. The attested forms are anawak, anawak, and sumawak and sinawak. But more importantly, the meaning is given as to call out, to come for help, to request, or to beg. Now that doesn't really match closely. You talk about conservativeness in your semantic matches. That hardly is a close match for to gather and make a noise in disorder. Okay?
Well, we can argue about individual items, you know.
One by one.
One by one. However, people take different attitudes to that. You think that it's not sufficiently semantically close. Another reviewer on the taking the whole list said that the semantics were too close. The meanings were too close, and that after that period of time, you would expect greater divergence. So you think they're too close. He thinks they're too far.
Well, recall now, you haven't quoted the entire class. You've only quoted part of it. So that reviewer probably was just looking at the part that you quoted. I'll let it rest there so other people can.
I guess Bob beat me to the punch. I'm Mike Petrusevsky, Department of Anthropology. I think we had some correspondence.
Yes.
I think your talk points out some of the hazards of taking data from fields that you might not be fully aware of the context in which some of these results are presented. Looking at some of the results that you gave, your Tanaka, molecular genetics, on distance analysis of cranial measurements, I think it was Hanifara's junior study you were pointing out. And the Russian, you were showing a graph there that happened to show a connection between Java and Ryugu, or whatever it was. The problem with that is that graph, by the way, was a frequency of two non-metric traits taken at random. I think you have to search quite far before you can find maybe a connection there. But if you looked at the other 90 traits, you might not have seen any connection. And I think the point I want to make is you're being very selective in looking for a connection between Java and Japan and Yayoi. And yes, you can find them anywhere, just like you can find connections between anything in the entire universe.
No,
it doesn't prove anything. And I think you've misinterpreted the data from biological anthropology completely, as well as the molecular. So I think you're giving a very slanted view, all to maybe feed into your hypothesis that you want to demonstrate. But I think that's dangerous and rather haphazard, and it certainly wouldn't make peer review.
Well, it has made peer review. I mean, I have done a deal with a study with Simon Easter, which has been peer reviewed.
Well, it wouldn't make my peer review, that's it.
Well, all right, and I don't agree with your statement that you can find connections between any two places.
You can. I'm sure you
can.
With D-loops and DNA, you can find connections all around the world, not surprisingly.
I have given two examples here, but in my book I give many more studies than that.
You're very selective, I think, in your examples. There's no overall context. You're just taking selectively this and that.
I have given overall context in the seminar. I give only two examples.
Well, majority of physical anthropologists working in Japan and outside Japan do not agree with your final conclusion regarding northern and southern origins of the other. Sorry to say.
Well, I'm not terribly sorry to say. This is a new proposal.
Right.
Maybe we can move on.
It's a new proposal, yes.
Maybe we can move on. About Ulu rice.
Yes.
This is also a term in rice studies that was used in about the 60s, and the USDA Department of Agriculture also had a category for Ulu rice, but rice taxonomies have been very unstable and very unconsolidated internationally forever. And today that word is no longer really used, or Javanica.
Well, I can use Javanica if you prefer.
But maybe you could say something about where that research has
Well, Javanica or Bulu has not been heavily researched since the 60s because the principal attention has been given to rice varieties which have been used in American programs or in the high-yielding variety programs. So most of the research has been concentrated on Indica and Japonica rather than
Javanica and Japonica cross fertilize?
They do to a certain extent. I mean, this is not an either or distinction. It's a matter of percentage of the interfertility.
Well, without gamma ray, that natural.
Yes, this was based on natural.
There's been quite a lot of work on architectural similarities.
Yes,
is that coincidental, or is there something real there?
No, it's not coincidental. I mean, for instance, Roxana Waterson's book on the living house, which deals with Southeast Asian architecture, comments on the great similarity between the Indonesian architectural forms and the Japanese, both the granary and the temple forms, and I deal with architecture. That is a typological similarity. There are many typological similarities. For instance, the pottery of the Yayoi period is very distinct from the pottery of the Jomon period. It's very similar to Javanese pottery. The architecture is very similar. The metalworking has similar motifs. I mean, there are all these, the masks look the same. There are many things that look the same. But, you know, I have tried to go beyond the typological similarities to genetic similarities.
So. Is there any indication that the Javanese might have come not on the currents but along the coast and jumped over into the Korean Peninsula before hitting Japan?
I haven't looked at that possibility. In historical times, the Javanese were, for instance, raiding by sea as far north as the Tonkin Delta. So I would imagine that the easiest method was to go by sea, and easier to go.
Well, I seem to recall that evidence of wet rice agriculture in a period significantly earlier than in Japan has been found in the southern, but only the southern Korean peninsula, approximately, let's say, across from Shandong or something like that. And any comments on that? Is that
I'm not attempting to say that rice didn't come from anywhere else in Japan. I'm merely saying that Javanica has made a contribution to the Japanese rice pool. In fact, Javanica itself is still grown in Japan. In the timeline that I started with, you can see that rice cultivation developed in Indonesia much earlier than it did in Japan, as did metalworking.
When I was studying with Bill Thalheim, one of the things I looked at a lot was the connection between Eastern Asia and Southeast Asia. And we know there was later trade in the 14th century from Ryukyu down to Java a lot. So the question is, you know, whether there were perhaps early precursors to that one. On the other hand, I could see relationships between aspects of Jomon pottery. Some of the pottery you find in New Guinea, and some of Jomon pottery, and some of the pottery you find in England. It's not that there are no connections there, there seem to be connections. I also saw some of the same similar connections you saw from the Dukdak between that upraised linear surface patterning with all the edge patterns on the Dukdak that you also see in bronze forms in Southeast Asia. My question would be, is there a possibility of a larger connection that sort of underlies this connection that you're talking about?
Well, yes.
A family connection.
I don't think it's a connection with the whole Austronesian world. There could be some larger connection because the prehistory of that period is very badly studied. I mean, Japanese prehistory is relatively well studied. Japanese prehistory is abysmally badly studied. I mean, the attention in Java has been A, to the early hominids which were found there, the Dubois finds, or to the later period of the Hinduized kingdoms, which produced spectacular gold hoards and so on. The kind of in-between period, which I'm dealing with, is very badly researched, so we don't really know a lot about what happened in that period.
Because I know that there were very long swords in old Japanese archaeology. There's not much known about this. Some of them were found in Hajar village, in a cemetery in South Java. I've seen some of them, and some of them are laminated. And exactly how old they are, whether any of them ever had bronze fittings, I have no idea. The bronze fittings from Yayoi that I've seen don't look anything like anything from Java I'm aware of.
Well, that's very interesting, and I'd like to have some more information about those swords. It's an example of the really inadequate study of Japanese prehistory. It would take rather a long time to go into this, but the technique of production of the Japanese sword is the same as the technique of production of the kris. And the early kris are very similar in shape to the Yayoi daggers. But that's not the only similarity in form. But I'd certainly like to get some more information about the swords, which I really haven't been aware of.
Well, there's a few other bits of connection, I think, in one of the earliest Japanese myths of where the first holy swords came from. They were found in the tail of a dragon. And if you look very carefully at the mandal from Borneo, some of the mandals have snake heads, and the blade is the tail. So the same similar kind of idea of the snake laying head to head and tail to tail is there. It's hard to know. I mean, this is in the context, what you're presenting is in the context of a much larger book.
Yes.
Do you yourself see a particular strongest part of your argument lying in one segment of the book?
I don't think you can argue with the DNA evidence, and Professor Blustein, I think the linguistic evidence is very strong.
I would even argue with Bob, because I don't think you can compare Zipmulder, who's talking about Sanskrit as formal court literature, to spoken language. I mean, we have no knowledge of what's spoken in old Japanese literature.
I'm well aware of that. We're talking about it. We'll talk about this in greater length.
What about shipping technology? Is there any evidence in Japanese archaeology of technological borrowings in terms of shipping, building ships? We've been brought up with these ideas of special Southeast Asian ships or whatever.
Well, that's a very good question, and one which I haven't gone into at all. I mean, Adrian Horridge is one of the big experts on the Indonesian prow, but I really haven't looked at it.
But the period we're talking about, Yayoi, corresponds quite closely to the Bronze Age of Indonesia, where obviously there's a lot of trade going over a wide area of Southeast Asia and into Yunnan as well, of bronzes. And there's good reason to suspect that when you look at Yayoi bronzes, they don't look entirely Chinese. We have bronze mirrors, perhaps. That idea comes from China, but the bells don't look.
Yeah.
And particularly the decoration of bells looks closer to Yunnan and some of the so-called dansong types of decoration. In addition, the architecture that's shown, I think if we restrict ourselves to Java, we won't see too much, but if you look at the tribal areas of Indonesia, as Warsaw points out as well, I could show you pictures that really show very strong relationships in terms of style. But that doesn't prove a connection, but I think that into a bill of goods.
Sorry, what was your name?
I'm Jerome Feldman. I teach at HP.
provocative session, a good way to end the semester, stimulate our brains ready for the final haul. So I want to thank Anne for coming on, and thank all you for coming, for your questions, and of course she'll be here until the 12th, so if some of you want to see her further or talk to me privately, but please join me in thanking her.
This podcast is a production of the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii. The center's director is Professor Barbara Watson Andaya. The associate director is Paul Rausch. The Brown Bag series is coordinated by Hua Lei, and the podcast series is produced by Christian Razukas. Your announcer is Nozia Azmi. This is a free service made possible by the center, the University of Hawaii, and the United States Department of Education. For more podcasts, videos, and information about Southeast Asia, visit our website at hawaii.edu/CSEAS.